Disc 3.
Chapter 13. Second Visitor. At the sight of Mrs. Oliver, Major Despard looked slightly taken aback. Under his tan, his face flushed a rich brick red. Embarrassment made him jerky. He made for Anne. I apologize, Miss Meredith, he said. Been ringing your bell. Nothing happened. Was passing this way. Thought I might just look you up. I'm so sorry you've been ringing, said Anne. We haven't got a maid, only a woman who comes in the mornings. She introduced him to Rhoda. Rhoda said briskly, Let's have some tea. It's getting chilly. We'd better go in. They all went into the house. Rhoda disappeared into the kitchen. Mrs. Oliver said, This is quite a coincidence. Our all meeting here. Despard said slowly, Yes. His eyes rested on her thoughtfully. Appraising eyes. I've been telling Miss Meredith, said Mrs. Oliver, who was thoroughly enjoying herself, that we ought to have a plan of campaign. About the murder, I mean. Of course that doctor did it. Don't you agree with me? Couldn't say. Very little to go on. Mrs. Oliver put on her how like a man expression. A certain air of constraint had settled over the three. Mrs. Oliver sensed it quickly enough. When Rhoda brought in tea, she rose and said she must be getting back to town. No, it was ever so kind of them, but she wouldn't have any tea. I'm going to leave you my card, she said. Here it is, with my address on it. Come and see me when you come up to town, and we'll talk everything over and see if we can't think of something ingenious to get to the bottom of things. I'll come out to the gate with you, said Rhoda. Just as they were walking down the path to the front gate, Anne Meredith ran out of the house and overtook them. I've been thinking things over, she said. Her pale face looked unusually resolute. Yes, my dear? It's extraordinarily kind of you, Mrs. Oliver, to have taken all this trouble, but I'd really rather not do anything at all. I mean, it was all so horrible. I just want to forget about it. My dear child, the question is, will you be allowed to forget about it? Oh, I quite understand that the police won't let it drop. They'll probably come here and ask me a lot more questions. I'm prepared for that. But privately, I mean, I don't want to think about it, or be reminded of it in any way. I dare say I'm a coward, but that's how I feel about it. Oh, Anne, cried Rhoda Dawes. I can understand your feeling, but I'm not at all sure that you're wise, said Mrs. Oliver. Left to themselves, the police will probably never find out the truth. Anne Meredith shrugged her shoulders. Does that really matter? Matter? Cried Rhoda. Of course it matters. It does matter, doesn't it, Mrs. Oliver? I should certainly say so, said Mrs. Oliver dryly. I don't agree, said Anne obstinately. Nobody who knows me would ever think I'd done it. I don't see any reason for interfering. It's the business of the police to get at the truth. Oh, Anne, you are spiritless, said Rhoda. That's how I feel anyway, said Anne. She held out her hand. Thank you very much, Mrs. Oliver. It's very good of you to have bothered.
Well, of course, if you feel that way. There's nothing more to be said, said Mrs. Oliver cheerfully. I, at any rate, shall not let the grass grow under my feet. Goodbye, my dear. Look me up in London if you change your mind.
She climbed into the car, started it, and drove off, waving a cheery hand at the two girls. Rhoda suddenly made a dash after the car and leapt on the running board.
What you said about looking you up in London, she said breathlessly. Did you only mean Anne, or did you mean me too?
Mrs. Oliver applied the brake.
I meant both of you, of course.
Oh, thank you. Don't stop. I perhaps might come one day. There's something... No, don't stop. I can jump off.
She did so, and waving a hand, ran back to the gate, where Anne was standing.
What on earth? Began Anne.
Isn't she a duck? Asked Rhoda enthusiastically. I do like her. She had on odd stockings, did you notice? I'm sure she's frightfully clever. She must be, to write all those books. What fun if she found out the truth when the police and everyone were baffled.
Why did she come here? Asked Anne.
Rhoda's eyes opened wide.
Darling, she told you.
Anne made an impatient gesture.
We must go in. I forgot. I've left him all alone. Major Despard? Anne, he's frightfully good-looking, isn't he?
I suppose he is. They walked up the path together. Major Despard was standing by the mantelpiece, teacup in hand. He cut short Anne's apologies for leaving him.
Miss Meredith, I want to explain why I've butted in like this.
Oh, but
I said that I happened to be passing. That wasn't strictly true. I came here on purpose.
How did you know my address?
Asked Anne slowly.
I got it from Superintendent Battle.
He saw her shrink slightly at the name. He went on quickly.
Battle's on his way here now. I happened to see him at Paddington. I got my car out and came down here. I knew I could beat the train easily.
But why?
Despard hesitated just a minute.
I may have been presumptuous, but I had the impression that you were, perhaps, what is called, alone in the world.
She's got me, said Rhoda.
Despard shot a quick glance at her, rather liking the gallant, boyish figure that leant against the mantelpiece and was following his words so intensely. They were an attractive pair, these two.
I'm sure she couldn't have a more devoted friend than you, Miss Dawes, he said courteously, but it occurred to me that, in the peculiar circumstances, the advice of someone with a good dash of world wisdom might not be amiss. Frankly, the situation is this. Miss Meredith is under suspicion of having committed murder. The same thing applies to me, and to the two other people who were in the room last night. Such a situation is not agreeable, and it has its own peculiar difficulties and dangers which someone as young and inexperienced as you are, Miss Meredith, might not recognize. In my opinion, you ought to put yourself in the hands of a thoroughly good solicitor. Perhaps you've already done so.
Anne Meredith shook her head.
I never thought of it.
Exactly as I suspected. Have you got a good man? A London man for choice.
Again, Anne shook her head.
I've hardly ever needed a solicitor. There's Mr. Berry, said Rhoda, but he's about 102 and quite gaga.
If you'll allow me to advise you, Miss Meredith, I recommend your going to Mr. Myhern, my own solicitor. Jacobs, Peel and Jacobs is the actual name of the firm. They're first-class people, and they know all the ropes.
Anne had got paler. She sat down.
Is it really necessary?
She asked in a low voice.
I should say emphatically so. There are all sorts of legal pitfalls.
Are these people very expensive?
That doesn't matter a bit, said Rhoda. That will be quite all right, Major Despard. I think everything you say is quite true and ought to be protected.
Their charges will, I think, be quite reasonable, said Despard. He added seriously, I really do think it's a wise course, Miss Meredith.
Very well, said Anne slowly.
I'll do it, if you think so.
Good.
Rhoda said warmly,
I think it's awfully nice of you, Major Despard. Really frightfully nice.
Anne said,
Thank you.
She hesitated and then said,
Did you say Superintendent Battle was coming here?
Yes. You mustn't be alarmed by that. It's inevitable.
Oh, I know. As a matter of fact, I've been expecting him,
Rhoda said impulsively.
Poor darling. It's nearly killing her, this business. It's such a shame, so frightfully unfair.
Despard said, I agree. It's a pretty beastly business, dragging a young girl into an affair of this kind. If anyone wanted to stick a knife into Shaitana, they ought to have chosen some other place or time. Rhoda asked squarely,
Who do you think did it? Dr. Roberts, or that Mrs. Lorimer?
A very faint smile stirred Despard's moustache.
May have done it myself, for all you know.
Oh, no, cried Rhoda. Anne and I know you didn't do it.
He looked at them both with kindly eyes. A nice pair of kids, touchingly full of faith and trust. A timid little creature, the Meredith girl. Never mind. Myhern would see her through. The other was a fighter. He doubted if she would have crumpled up in the same way if she'd been in her friend's place. Nice girls. He'd like to know more about them. These thoughts passed through his mind. Aloud he said,
Never take anything for granted, Miss Dawes. I don't set as much value on human life as most people do. All this hysterical fuss about road deaths, for instance. Man is always in danger, from traffic, from germs, from 101 things. As well be killed one way as another. The moment you begin being careful of yourself, adopting as your motto, safety first,
You might as well be dead, in my opinion.
Oh, I agree with you, cried Rhoda. I think one ought to live frightfully dangerously, if one gets the chance, that is. But life, on the whole, is terribly tame.
It has its moments.
Yes, for you. You go to out-of-the-way places, and get mauled by tigers, and shoot things, and jiggers bury themselves in your toes, and insects sting you, and everything's terribly uncomfortable, but frightfully thrilling.
Well, Miss Meredith has had her thrill, too. I don't suppose it often happens that you've actually been in the room while a murder was committed.
Oh, don't, cried Anne.
He said quickly, I'm sorry. But Rhoda said with a sigh,
of course it was awful, but it was exciting too. I don't think Anne appreciates that side of it. You know, I think that Mrs. Oliver is thrilled to the core to have been there that night.
Mrs. Oh, your fat friend who writes the books about the unpronounceable Finn. Is she trying her hand at detection in real life?
She wants to.
Well, let's wish her luck. It would be amusing if she put one over on Battle and Co.
What is Superintendent Battle like?
Asked Rhoda curiously. Major Despard said gravely, he's an extraordinarily astute man. A man of remarkable ability.
Oh, said Rhoda. Anne said he looked rather stupid.
That, I should imagine, is part of Battle's stock in trade. But we mustn't make any mistakes. Battle's no fool. He rose. Well, I must be off. There's just one other thing I'd like to say. Anne had risen also.
Yes, she said as she held out her hand.
Despard paused a minute, picking his words carefully. He took her hand and retained it in his. He looked straight into the wide, beautiful grey eyes. Don't be offended with me, he said. I just want to say this. It's humanly possible that there may be some feature of your acquaintanceship with Shaitana that you don't want to come out. If so, don't be angry, please. He felt the instinctive pull of her hand. You are perfectly within your rights in refusing to answer any questions Battle may ask, unless your solicitor is present. Anne tore her hand away. Her eyes opened, their grey darkening with anger.
There's nothing. Nothing. I hardly knew the beastly man.
Sorry, said Major Despard. Thought I ought to mention it.
It's quite true, said Rhoda. Anne barely knew him. She didn't like him much, but he gave frightfully good parties.
That, said Major Despard grimly, seems to have been the only justification for the late Mr. Shaitana's existence. Anne said in a cold voice,
Superintendent Battle can ask me anything he likes. I've nothing to hide. Nothing.
Despard said very gently, Please, forgive me. She looked at him. Her anger dwindled. She smiled. It was a very sweet smile.
It's all right, she said. You meant it kindly. I know.
She held out her hand again. He took it and said, We're in the same boat, you know. We ought to be pals. It was Anne who went with him to the gate. When she came back, Rhoda was staring out of the window and whistling. She turned as her friend entered the room.
He's frightfully attractive, Anne.
He's nice, isn't he?
Great deal more than nice. I've got an absolute passion for him. Why wasn't I at that damned dinner instead of you? I'd have enjoyed the excitement. The net closing round me, the shadow of the scaffold.
No, you wouldn't. You're talking nonsense, Rhoda. Anne's voice was sharp. Then it softened as she said,
It was nice of him to come all this way. For a stranger. A girl he's only met once.
Oh, he fell for you, obviously. Men don't do purely disinterested kindnesses. He wouldn't have come toddling down if you'd been cross-eyed and covered with pimples.
Don't you think so?
I do not, my good idiot. Mrs. Oliver's a much more disinterested party.
I don't like her, said Anne abruptly. I had a sort of feeling about her. I wonder what she really came for.
The usual suspicions of your own sex. I dare say Major Despard had an axe to grind if it comes to that.
I'm sure he hadn't, cried Anne hotly.
Then she blushed as Rhoda Dawes laughed. Chapter 14 Third Visitor Superintendent Battle arrived at Wallingford about 6 o'clock. It was his intention to learn as much as he could from innocent local gossip before interviewing Miss Anne Meredith. It was not difficult to glean such information as there was. Without committing himself definitely to any statement, the superintendent nevertheless gave several different impressions of his rank and calling in life. At least two people would have said confidently that he was a London builder, come down to see about a new wing to be added to the cottage. From another, you would have learned that he was one of these weekenders wanting to take a furnished cottage. And two more would have said they knew positively, and for a fact, that he was a representative of a hard-court tennis firm. The information that the superintendent gathered was entirely favourable. Wyndham Cottage. Yes, that's right, on the Marbury Road. You can't miss it. Yes, two young ladies, Miss Dawes and Miss Meredith. Very nice young ladies, too. The quiet kind. Here for years? Oh, no, not that long. Just over 2 years. September quarter they come in. Mr. Piggersgill they bought it from. Never used it much, he didn't, after his wife died. Superintendent Battle's informant had never heard they came from Northumberland. London, he thought they came from. Popular in the neighbourhood, though some people were old-fashioned and didn't think two young ladies ought to be living alone. But very quiet they were. None of this cocktail-drinking weekend lot. Miss Rhoda, she was the dashing one. Miss Meredith was the quiet one. Yes, it was Miss Dawes what paid the bills. She was the one had got the money. The superintendent's researches at last led him inevitably to Mrs. Astwell, who did for the ladies at Wyndham Cottage. Mrs. Astwell was a loquacious lady. Well, no, sir, I hardly think they want to sell. Not so soon. They only got in 2 years ago. I've done for them from the beginning, yes, sir. 8 o'clock till 12. Those are my hours. Very nice. Lively young ladies, always ready for a joke or a bit of fun. Not stuck up at all. Well, of course, I couldn't say if it's the same Miss Dawes you knew, sir. Same family, I mean. It's my fancy. Her home's in Devonshire. She gets the cream sent to her now and again, and says it reminds her of home, so I think it must be. Well, as you say, sir, it's sad for so many young ladies having to earn their living nowadays. These young ladies aren't what you'd call rich, but they have a very pleasant life. It's Miss Dawes has got the money, of course. Miss Anne's her companion, in a manner of speaking, I suppose you might say. The cottage belongs to Miss Dawes. I couldn't really say what part Miss Anne comes from. I've heard her mention the Isle of Wight, and I know she doesn't like the north of England, and she and Miss Rhoda were together in Devonshire, because I've heard them joke about the hills and talk about the pretty coves and beaches. The flow went on. Every now and then, Superintendent Battle made a mental note. Later, a cryptic word or two was jotted down in his little book. At 8:30 that evening, he walked up the path to the door of Wyndham Cottage. It was opened to him by a tall, dark girl, wearing a frock of orange cretonne. "Miss Meredith live here?" inquired Superintendent Battle. He looked very wooden and soldierly. "Yes, she does." "I'd like to speak to her, please. Superintendent Battle." He was immediately favoured with a piercing stare. "Come in," said Rhoda Dawes, drawing back from the doorway. Anne Meredith was sitting in a cosy chair by the fire, sipping coffee. She was wearing embroidered crepe de chine pyjamas. "It's Superintendent Battle," said Rhoda, ushering in the guest. Anne rose and came forward with outstretched hand. "A bit late for a call," said Battle, "but I wanted to find you in, and it's been a fine day." Anne smiled. "Will you have some coffee, Superintendent? Rhoda, fetch another cup."
"Well, it's very kind of you, Miss Meredith."
"We think we make rather good coffee," said Anne. She indicated a chair, and Superintendent Battle sat down. Rhoda brought a cup, and Anne poured out his coffee. The fire crackled, and the flowers in the vases made an agreeable impression upon the superintendent. It was a pleasant, homey atmosphere. Anne seemed self-possessed and at her ease, and the other girl continued to stare at him with devouring interest.
"We've been expecting you," said Anne. Her tone was almost reproachful. "Why have you neglected me?" it seemed to say.
Sorry, Miss Meredith, I've had a lot of routine work to do."
"Satisfactory?"
Not particularly, but it all has to be done. I've turned Dr. Roberts inside out, so to speak, and the same for Mrs. Lorimer. And now I've come to do the same for you, Miss Meredith." Anne smiled.
"I'm ready."
"What about Major Despard?" asked Rhoda.
"Oh, he won't be overlooked, I can promise you that," said Battle.
He set down his coffee cup and looked towards Anne. She sat up a little straighter in her chair.
I'm quite ready, Superintendent. What do you want to know?
Well, roughly all about yourself, Miss Meredith.
I'm quite a respectable person, said Anne, smiling. She's led a blameless life, too, said Rhoda. I can answer for that.
Well, that's very nice, said Superintendent Battle cheerfully. You've known Miss Meredith a long time, then.
We were at school together, said Rhoda. What ages ago, it seems, doesn't it, Anne?
So long you can hardly remember it, I suppose, said Battle with a chuckle. Now then, Miss Meredith, I'm afraid I'm going to be rather like those forms you fill up for passports.
I was born, began Anne, of poor but honest parents, Rhoda put in.
Superintendent Battle held up a slightly reproving hand.
Now, young lady, he said.
Rhoda, darling, said Anne gravely, it's serious, this.
Sorry,
said Rhoda.
Now, Miss Meredith, you were born where?
At Quetta, in India.
Ah, yes. Your people were army folk?
Yes, my father was Major John Meredith. My mother died when I was 11. Father retired when I was 15 and went to live in Cheltenham. He died when I was 18 and left practically no money.
Battle nodded his head sympathetically.
Bit of a shock to you, I expect.
It was, rather. I always knew that we weren't well off, but to find there was practically nothing, well, that's different.
What did you do, Miss Meredith?
I had to take a job. I hadn't been particularly well educated, and I wasn't clever. I didn't know typing or shorthand or anything. A friend in Cheltenham found me a job with friends of hers, two small boys, home in the holidays, and general help in the house.
Name, please?
That was Mrs. Eldon, the Larches, Ventnor. I stayed there for 2 years, and then the Eldons went abroad. Then I went to a Mrs. Deering. My aunt, put in Rhoda. Yes, Rhoda got me the job. I was very happy. Rhoda used to come and stay sometimes, and we had great fun.
What were you there? Companion?
Yes, it amounted to that. More like under-gardener, said Rhoda. She explained, my Aunt Emily is just mad on gardening. Anne spent most of her time weeding or putting in bulbs.
And you left Mrs. Deering?
Her health got worse, and she had to have a regular nurse. She's got cancer, said Rhoda. Poor darling, she has to have morphia and things like that. She had been very kind to me. I was very sorry to go, went on Anne. I was looking about for a cottage, said Rhoda, and wanting someone to share it with me. Daddy's married again, not my sort at all. I asked Anne to come here with me, and she's been here ever since.
Well, that certainly seems a most blameless life, said Battle. Let's just get the dates clear. You were with Mrs. Eldon 2 years, you say. By the way, what is her address now?
She's in Palestine. Her husband has some government appointment out there. I'm not sure what.
Ah, well, I can soon find out. And after that, you went to Mrs. Deering.
I was with her 3 years, said Anne quickly. Her address is Marsh Dean, Little Hembury, Devon.
I see, said Battle. So you are now 25, Miss Meredith. Now, there's just one more thing. The name and address of a couple of people in Cheltenham who knew you and your father.
Anne supplied him with these.
Now, about this trip to Switzerland, where you met Mr. Shaitana, did you go there alone, or was Miss Dawes here with you?
We went out together. We joined some other people. There was a party of eight.
Tell me about your meeting with Mr. Shaitana.
Anne crinkled her brows.
There's really nothing to tell. He was just there. We knew him in the way you know people in a hotel. He got first prize at the fancy dress ball. He went as Mephistopheles.
Superintendent Battle sighed.
Yes, that was always his favourite effect.
He really was marvellous, said Rhoda. Hardly had to make up at all.
The superintendent looked from one girl to the other.
Which of you two young ladies knew him best?
Anne hesitated. It was Rhoda who answered.
Both the same to begin with. Awfully little, that is.
You see, our crowd was the skiing lot, and we were off doing runs most days and dancing together in the evenings. But then Shaitana seemed to take rather a fancy to Anne, you know, went out of his way to pay her compliments and all that. We ragged her about it, rather.
I just think he did it to annoy me, said Anne, because I didn't like him. I think it amused him to make me feel embarrassed.
Rhoda said, laughing. We told Anne it would be a nice rich marriage for her. She got simply wild with us.
Perhaps, said Battle, you'd give me the names of the other people in your party.
You aren't what I call a trustful man, said Rhoda.
Do you think that every word we're telling you is downright lies?
Superintendent Battle twinkled. I'm going to make sure it isn't, anyway, he said.
You are suspicious, said Rhoda.
She scribbled some names on a piece of paper and gave it to him. Battle rose. Well, thank you very much, Miss Meredith, he said. As Miss Dawes says, you seem to have led a particularly blameless life. I don't think you need to worry much. It's odd the way Mr. Shaitana's manner changed you. You'll excuse my asking, but he didn't ask you to marry him, or pester you with attentions of another kind?
He didn't try to seduce her, said Rhoda helpfully, if that's what you mean.
Anne was blushing.
Nothing of the kind, she said. He was always most polite and formal. It was just his elaborate manners that made me uncomfortable.
And little things he said or hinted?
Yes. At least, no. He never hinted things.
Sorry. These lady killers do sometimes. Well, good night, Miss Meredith. Thank you very much. Excellent coffee. Good night, Miss Dawes.
There, said Rhoda, as Anne came back into the room after shutting the door after Battle. That's over. And not so very terrible. He's a nice fatherly man, and he evidently doesn't suspect you in the least. It was all ever so much better than I expected.
Anne sank down with a sigh.
It was really quite easy, she said. It was silly of me to work myself up so. I thought he'd try to browbeat me, like KC's on the stage.
He looks sensible, said Rhoda.
He'd know well enough you're not a murdering kind of female.
She hesitated, and then said,
I say, Anne, you didn't mention being at Croftways. Did you forget?
Anne said slowly,
I didn't think it counted. I was only there a few months, and there's no one to ask about me there. I can write and tell him if you think it matters, but I'm sure it doesn't. Let's leave it.
Right, if you say so. Rhoda rose and turned on the wireless. A raucous voice said,
You've just heard the Black Nubians play Why Do You Tell Me Lies, Baby?
Chapter 15 Major Despard. Major Despard came out of the Albany, turned sharply into Regent Street, and jumped on a bus. It was the quiet time of day. The top of the bus had very few seats occupied. Despard made his way forward and sat down on the front seat. He had jumped on the bus while it was going. Now it came to a halt, took up passengers, and made its way once more up Regent Street. A second traveller climbed the steps, made his way forward, and sat down in the front seat on the other side. Despard did not notice the newcomer, but after a few minutes, a tentative voice murmured,
It is a good view of London, is it not, that one gets from the top of a bus?
Despard turned his head. He looked puzzled for a moment, then his face cleared.
Ah, I beg your pardon, Monsieur Poirot. I didn't see it was you. Yes, as you say. One has a good bird's-eye view of the world from here. It was better there in the old days, when there wasn't all this caged-in glass business.
Poirot sighed.
Tout de même.
It was not always agreeable in the wet weather when the inside was full, and there is much wet weather in this country.
Rain? Rain never did any harm to anyone.
You are in error, said Poirot. It leads often to effluxion de poitrine.
Despard smiled. I see you belong to the well-wrapped-up school, Monsieur Poirot.
Poirot was indeed well-equipped against any treachery of an autumn day. He wore a greatcoat and a muffler.
Rather odd, running into you like this, said Despard.
He did not see the smile that the muffler concealed. There was nothing odd in this encounter. Having ascertained a likely hour for Despard to leave his rooms,
Poirot had been waiting for him. He had prudently not risked leaping on the bus, but had trotted after it to its next stopping place and boarded it there. "True, we have not seen each other since the evening at Mr. Chetana's," he replied.
"Aren't you taking a hand in the business?" asked Despard.
Poirot scratched his ear delicately.
"I reflect," he said. "I reflect a good deal. To run to and fro, to make the investigations, that, no. It does not suit my age, my temperament, or my figure."
Despard said unexpectedly,
"A reflect, eh? Well, you might do worse. There's too much rushing about nowadays. If people sat tight and thought about a thing before they tackled it, there'd be less mess-ups than there are."
"Is that your procedure in life, Major Despard?"
"Usually," said the other simply. "Get your bearings, figure out your route, weigh up the pros and cons, make your decision, stick to it."
His mouth set grimly.
"And after that, nothing will turn you from your path, eh?" asked Poirot.
"Oh, I don't say that. No use in being pig-headed over things. If you've made a mistake, admit it."
"But I imagine that you do not often make a mistake, Monsieur Despard."
"We all make mistakes, Monsieur Poirot."
"Some of us," said Poirot with a certain coldness, possibly due to the pronoun the other had used, "make less than others."
Despard looked at him, smiled slightly, and said, "Don't you ever have a failure, Monsieur Poirot?"
"The last time was 28 years ago," said Poirot with dignity, "and even then there were circumstances, but no matter."
"Well, that seems a pretty good record," said Despard. He added, "What about Chetana's death? That doesn't count, I suppose, since it isn't officially your business."
"It is not my business, no, but all the same it offends my amour-propre. I consider it an impertinence, you comprehend, for a murder to be committed under my very nose by someone who mocks himself at my ability to solve it."
"Not under your nose only," said Despard dryly. "Under the nose of the Criminal Investigation Department also."
"That was probably a bad mistake," said Poirot gravely.
"The good Superintendent Battle, he may look wooden, but he is not wooden in the head, not at all."
"I agree," said Despard. "That stolidity is a pose. He's a very clever and able officer."
"And I think he is very active in the case."
"Oh, he's active enough. See a nice, quiet, soldierly-looking fellow on one of the back seats?"
Poirot looked over his shoulder.
"There is no one here now but ourselves."
"Oh, well, he's inside, then. He never loses me. Very efficient fellow. Varies his appearance, too, from time to time. Quite artistic about it."
"Ah, but that would not deceive you. You have the very quick and accurate eye."
"I never forget a face, and that's a lot more than most people can say."
"You are just the person I need," said Poirot. "What a chance meeting you today. I need someone with a good eye and a good memory. Malheureusement, the two seldom go together. I have asked the Dr. Roberts a question, without result, and the same with Madame Lorimer. Now I will try you and see if I get what I want. Cast your mind back to the room in which you played cards at Mr. Chetana's, and tell me what you remember of it."
Despard looked puzzled.
"I don't quite understand.
Give me a description of the room, the furnishing, the objects in it."
"Oh, I don't know that I'm much of a hand at that sort of thing," said Despard. "It was a rotten sort of room, to my mind. Not a man's room at all. A lot of brocade and silk and stuff. Sort of room a fellow like Chetana would have."
"But to particularize."
Despard shook his head. "Afraid I didn't notice. He'd got some good rugs. 2 Bokharas and 3 or 4 really good Persian ones, including a Hamadan and a Tabriz. Rather a good Eland head. No, that was in the hall. From Roland Ward's, I expect."
"You do not think that the late Mr. Chetana was one to go out and shoot wild beasts?"
"Not he. Never potted anything but sitting game, I'll bet. What else was there?" "Sorry to fail you, but I really can't help much. Any amount of knick-knacks lying about. Tables were thick with them. Anything I noticed was a rather jolly idol. Easter Island, I should say. Highly polished wood. You don't see many of them. There was some Malay stuff, too. No, I'm afraid I can't help you."
"No matter," said Poirot, looking slightly crestfallen.
He went on.
Do you know, Mrs. Lorimer, that she has the most amazing card memory? She could tell me the bidding and the play of nearly every hand. It was astonishing.
Despard shrugged his shoulders. Some women are like that. Because they play pretty well all day long, I suppose.
You could not do it, huh? The other shook his head.
I just remember a couple of hands. One where I could have got game in diamonds, and Roberts bluffed me out of it. Went down himself, but we didn't double him. Worse luck. I remember a no-trumper, too. Tricky business. Every card wrong. We went down a couple. Lucky not to have gone down more.
Do you play much bridge, Major Despard?
No, I'm not a regular player. It's a good game, though.
You prefer it to poker?
I do, personally. Poker's too much of a gamble.
Poirot said thoughtfully,
I do not think Mr. Shitana played any game. Any card game, that is.
There's only one game that Shaitana played consistently, said Despard grimly.
And that?
A low-down game.
Poirot was silent for a minute. Then he said,
Is it that you know that,
or you just think it? Despard went brick red.
Meaning one oughtn't to say things without giving chapter and verse. I suppose that's true. Well, it's accurate enough. I happen to know. On the other hand, I'm not prepared to give chapter and verse. Such information as I've got came to me privately.
Meaning a woman, or women, are concerned.
Yes. Shaitana, like the dirty dog he was, preferred to deal with women.
You think he was a blackmailer? That is interesting.
Despard shook his head.
No, no. You've misunderstood me. In a way, Shaitana was a blackmailer, but not the common or garden sort. He wasn't after money. He was a spiritual blackmailer. If there can be such a thing.
And he got out of it what?
He got a kick out of it. That's the only way I can put it. He got a thrill out of seeing people quail and flinch. I suppose it made him feel less of a louse and more of a man. And it's a very effective pose with women. He'd only got to hint that he knew everything, and they'd start telling him a lot of things that perhaps he didn't know. That would tickle his sense of humour. Then he'd strut about in his Mephistophelian attitude of, I know everything. I am the great Shaitana. The man was an ape.
So you think that he frightened Miss Meredith that way? Said Poirot slowly.
Miss Meredith? Despard stared. I wasn't thinking of her. She isn't the kind to be afraid of a man like Shaitana.
Pardon. You meant Mrs. Lorimer?
No, no, no. You misunderstand me. I was speaking generally. It wouldn't be easy to frighten Mrs. Lorimer. And she's not the kind of woman who you can imagine having a guilty secret. No, I was not thinking of anyone in particular.
It was the general method to which you referred.
Exactly.
There is no doubt, said Poirot slowly, that what you call a dago often has a very clever understanding of women. He knows how to approach them. He worms secrets out of them.
He paused.
Despard broke in impatiently. It's absurd. The man was a mountebank. Nothing really dangerous about him, and yet women were afraid of him, ridiculously so.
He started up suddenly.
Hello, I've overshot the mark. Got too interested in what we were discussing. Goodbye, Monsieur Poirot. Look down, and you'll see my faithful shadow leaving the bus when I do.
He hurried to the back and down the steps. The conductor's bell jangled, but a double pull sounded before it had time to stop. Looking down to the street below, Poirot noticed Despard striding back along the pavement. He did not trouble to pick out the following figure. Something else was interesting him.
No one in particular, he murmured to himself. Now I wonder.
Chapter 16 The Evidence of Elsie Batt. Sergeant O'Connor was unkindly nicknamed by his colleagues at the yard the maidservant's prayer. There was no doubt that he was an extremely handsome man, tall, erect, broad-shouldered. It was less the regularity of his features than the roguish and daredevil spark in his eye which made him so irresistible to the fair sex. It was indubitable that Sergeant O'Connor got results, and got them quickly. So rapid was he that only 4 days after the murder of Mr. Shaitana, Sergeant O'Connor was sitting in the 3 and 6 penny seats at the Willy-Nilly Review, side by side with Miss Elsie Batt,
late parlourmaid, to Mrs. Craddock, of 117 North Audley Street. Having laid his line of approach carefully, Sergeant O'Connor was just launching the great offensive.
"Reminds me," he was saying, "of the way one of my old governors used to carry on, name of Craddock. He was an old cuss, if you like."
"Craddock?" said Elsie. "I was with some Craddocks once."
"Well, that's funny. Wonder whether they were the same."
"Lived in North Audley Street, they did," said Elsie.
"And my lot were going to London when I left them," said O'Connor promptly. "Yes, I believe it was North Audley Street. Mrs. Craddock was rather a one for the gents."
Elsie tossed her head.
"I'd no patience with her, always finding fault and grumbling. Nothing you did right."
"Her husband got some of it too, didn't he?
She was always complaining he neglected her, that he didn't understand her, and she was always saying how bad her health was, and gasping and groaning, not ill at all, if you ask me."
O'Connor slapped his knee.
"Got it. Wasn't there something about her and some doctor? A bit too thick or something?"
"Oh, you mean Dr. Roberts. He was a nice gentleman, he was."
"You girls, you're all alike," said Sergeant O'Connor. "The moment a man's a bad lot, all the girls stick up for him. I know his kind."
"No, you don't. And you're all wrong about him. There wasn't anything of that kind about him. Wasn't his fault, was it, if Mrs. Craddock was always sending for him? What's a doctor to do? If you ask me, he didn't think nothing of her at all, except as a patient. It was all her doing. Wouldn't leave him alone, she wouldn't."
"That's all very well, Elsie."
"It don't mind me calling you Elsie, do you? Feel as though I've known you all my life."
"Well, you haven't.
Elsie, indeed."
She tossed her head.
"Oh, very well, Miss Bat."
He gave her a glance.
"As I was saying, that's all very well, but the husband, he cut up rough all the same, didn't he?"
"He was a bit ratty one day," admitted Elsie.
"But if you ask me, he was ill at the time. He died just after, you know."
"I remember. Died of something queer, didn't he?"
"Something Japanese, it was. All from a new shaving brush he'd got.
Seems awful, doesn't it, that they're not more careful?
I've not fancied anything Japanese since."
"Buy British, that's my motto," said Sergeant O'Connor sententiously.
"And you were saying he and the doctor had a row?"
Elsie nodded, enjoying herself as she relived past scandals.
"Hammer and tongs they went at it," she said. "At least the master did. Dr. Roberts was ever so quiet, just said, 'Nonsense,' and 'What have you got into your head?'"
"This was at the house, I suppose?"
"Yes, she'd sent for him. And then she and the master had words, and in the middle of it, Dr. Roberts arrived, and the master went for him."
"What did he say exactly?"
"Well, of course, I wasn't supposed to hear. It was all in the missus's bedroom. I thought something was up, so I got the dustpan and did the stairs. I wasn't going to miss anything."
Sergeant O'Connor heartily concurred in this sentiment, reflecting how fortunate it was that Elsie was being approached unofficially. On interrogation by Sergeant O'Connor of the police, she would have virtuously protested that she had not overheard anything at all.
"As I say," went on Elsie, "Dr. Roberts, he was very quiet. The master was doing all the shouting."
"What was he saying?"
asked O'Connor, for the second time approaching the vital point.
"Abusing of him proper," said Elsie with relish.
"How do you mean?"
Would the girl never come to actual words and phrases?
"Well, I don't understand a lot of it," admitted Elsie. "There were a lot of long words, unprofessional conduct, and taking advantage, and things like that. And I heard him say he'd get Dr. Roberts struck off the, medical register, would it be? Something like that."
"That's right," said O'Connor.
"Complained to the medical council."
"Yeah, he said something like that. And the missus was going on in sort of hysterics, saying, 'You never cared for me, you neglected me, you left me alone.' And I heard her say that Dr. Roberts had been an angel of goodness to her. And then the doctor, he came through into the dressing room with the master and shut the door of the bedroom, and he said quite plain, 'My good man, don't you realise your wife's hysterical? She doesn't know what she's saying. To tell you the truth, it's been a very difficult and trying case, and I'd have thrown it up long ago if I thought it was some long word. Oh, yeah, consistent. That was it. Consistent with my duty.' That's what he said. He said something about not overstepping a boundary, too. Something between doctor and patient. He got the master quietened a bit, and then he said, 'You'll be late at the office, you know. You'd better be off. Just think things over quietly,
I think you'll realise that the whole business is a mare's nest. I'll just wash my hands here before I go on to my next case. Now you think it over, my dear fellow. I can assure you that the whole thing arises out of your wife's disordered imagination. And the master, he said, I don't know what to think. And he come out. And of course, I was brushing hard, but he never even noticed me. I thought afterwards he looked ill. The doctor, he was whistling quite cheerily and washing his hands in the dressing room, where there was hot and cold laid on. And presently he come out with his bag, and he spoke to me very nicely and cheerily, as he always did, and he went down the stairs quite cheerful and gay, as his usual self. So, you see, I'm quite sure, as he hadn't done anything wrong, it was all her. And then Craddock got this anthrax. Yeah, I think he got it already. The mistress, she nursed him, very devoted, but he died. Lovely wreaths there was at the funeral. And afterwards, did Dr. Roberts come to the house again? No, he didn't. Nosy. You've got some grudge against him. I tell you, there was nothing in it. If there were, he'd have married her when the master was dead, wouldn't he? And he never did. No such fool. He'd taken her measure all right. She used to ring him up, though, but somehow he was never in. And then she sold the house, and we all got our notices, and she went abroad to Egypt. And you didn't see Dr. Roberts in all that time? No, she did, because she went to him to have this, what do you call it? Inoculation against the typhoid fever. She came back with her arm ever so sore with it. If you ask me, he made it clear to her then that there was nothing doing. She didn't ring him up no more, and she went off very cheerful with a lovely lot of new clothes, all light colours, although it was the middle of winter, but she said it would be all sunshine and hot out there. That's right, said Sergeant O'Connor. It's too hot sometimes, I've heard. She died out there. You know that, I suppose. No, indeed I didn't. Well, fancy that. She may have been worse than I thought, poor soul, she added with a sigh. I wonder what they did with all that lovely lot of clothes. You'd have looked a treat in them, I expect, said Sergeant O'Connor. Impudence, said Elsie. Well, you won't have my impudence much longer, said Sergeant O'Connor. I've got to go away on business for my firm. Are you going for long? Maybe going abroad, said the sergeant. Elsie's face fell. Though unacquainted with Lord Byron's famous poem, I never loved a dear gazelle, etc., its sentiments were at that moment hers. She thought to herself, funny how all the really attractive ones never come to anything. Oh, well, there's always Fred. Which is gratifying, since it shows that the sudden incursion of Sergeant O'Connor into Elsie's life did not affect it permanently. Fred may even have been the gainer. Chapter 17. The Evidence of Rhoda Dawes. Rhoda Dawes came out of Debenhams and stood meditatively upon the pavement. Indecision was written all over her face. It was an expressive face. Each fleeting emotion showed itself in a quickly varying expression. Quite plainly, at this moment, Rhoda's face said, "Shall I or shan't I?" "I'd like to, but perhaps I'd better not." The commissionaire said, "Taxi, miss?" to her hopefully. Rhoda shook her head. A stout woman carrying parcels, with an eager shopping early for Christmas expression on her face, cannoned into her severely, but still Rhoda stood stock still, trying to make up her mind. Chaotic odds and ends of thought flashed through her mind. After all, why shouldn't I? She asked me to. But perhaps it's just a thing she says to everyone. She doesn't mean it to be taken seriously. Well, after all, Anne didn't want me. She made it quite clear she'd rather go with Major Despard to the solicitor man alone. And why shouldn't she? I mean, 3 years a crowd. And it isn't really any business of mine. It isn't as though I particularly wanted to see Major Despard. He is nice, though. I think he must have fallen for Anne. Men don't take a lot of trouble unless they have. I mean, it's never just kindness. A messenger boy bumped into Rhoda and said, "Beg pardon, miss," in a reproachful tone. Oh, dear, thought Rhoda. I can't go on standing here all day, just because I'm such an idiot that I can't make up my mind. I think that coat and skirt's going to be awfully nice. I wonder if brown would have been more useful than green. No, I don't think so. Well, come on, shall I go or shan't I? 3:30. It's quite a good time. I mean, it doesn't look as though I'm catching a meal or anything. I might just go and look, anyway.
She plunged across the road, turned to the right, and then to the left up Harley Street, finally pausing by the block of flats always airily described by Mrs. Oliver as all among the nursing homes.
Well, she can't eat me, thought Rhoda, and plunged boldly into the building.
Mrs. Oliver's flat was on the top floor. A uniformed attendant whisked her up in a lift and decanted her on a smart new mat outside a bright green door.
This is awful, thought Rhoda. Worse than dentists.
I must go through with it now, though. Pink with embarrassment, she pushed the bell. The door was opened by an elderly maid.
Is Mrs. Oliver at home? Asked Rhoda.
The maid drew back. Rhoda entered. She was shown into a very untidy drawing room. The maid said,
What name shall I say, please?
Miss Dawes. Miss Rhoda Dawes.
The maid withdrew. After what seemed to Rhoda about 100 years, but was really exactly 1 minute and 45 seconds, the maid returned.
Well, will you step this way, miss?
Pinker than ever, Rhoda followed her. Along a passage, round a corner, a door was opened. Nervously, she entered into what seemed at first, to her startled eyes, to be an African forest. Birds. Masses of birds, parrots, macaws. Birds unknown to ornithology twined themselves in and out of what seemed to be a primeval forest. In the middle of this riot of bird and vegetable life, Rhoda perceived a battered kitchen table with a typewriter on it, masses of typescript littered all over the floor, and Mrs. Oliver, her hair in wild confusion, rising from a somewhat rickety-looking chair.
"My dear, how nice to see you," said Mrs. Oliver,
holding out a carbon-stained hand and trying, with her other hand, to smooth her hair, a quite impossible proceeding. A paper bag, touched by her elbow, fell from the desk, and apples rolled energetically all over the floor.
"Oh, never mind, my dear, don't bother. Someone will pick them up sometime."
Rather breathless, Rhoda rose from a stooping position with 5 apples in her grasp.
"Oh, thank you. No, I shouldn't put them back in the bag. I think it's got a hole in it. Put them on the mantelpiece. That's right. Now then, sit down and let's talk."
Rhoda accepted a second battered chair and focused her eyes on her hostess.
"I say, I'm terribly sorry. Am I interrupting or anything?" she asked breathlessly. "Well, you are and you aren't," said Mrs. Oliver. "I am working, as you see, but that dreadful Finn of mine has got himself terribly tangled up. He did some awfully clever deduction with a dish of French beans, and now he's just detected deadly poison in the sage and onion stuffing of the Michaelmas goose, and I've just remembered that French beans are over by Michaelmas."
Thrilled by this peep into the inner world of creative detective fiction, Rhoda said breathlessly,
"Oh, they might be tinned."
They might, of course," said Mrs. Oliver doubtfully, "but it would rather spoil the point. I'm always getting tangled up in horticulture and things like that. People write to me and say I've got the wrong flowers all out together, as though it mattered. And anyway, they are all out together in a London shop."
"Well, of course it doesn't matter," said Rhoda loyally.
"Oh, Mrs. Oliver, it must be marvellous to write."
Mrs. Oliver rubbed her forehead with a carbony finger and said, "Why?"
"Oh," said Rhoda, a little taken aback.
"Because it must. It must be wonderful just to sit down and write off a whole book."
"It doesn't exactly happen like that," said Mrs. Oliver. "One actually has to think, you know, and thinking is always a bore, and you have to plan things, and then one gets stuck every now and then, and you feel you'll never get out of the mess, but you do. Writing's not particularly enjoyable. It's hard work, like everything else."
"It doesn't seem like work," said Rhoda.
"Not to you," said Mrs. Oliver, "because you don't have to do it. It feels very like work to me. Some days I can only keep going by repeating over and over to myself the amount of money I might get for my next serial rights. That spurs you on, you know. So does your bank book when you see how much overdrawn you are."
"I never imagined you actually typed your books yourself," said Rhoda. "I thought you'd have a secretary."
"I did have a secretary, and I used to try and dictate to her, but she was so competent that it used to depress me. I felt she knew so much more about English and grammar and full stops and semicolons than I did, that it gave me a kind of inferiority complex. Then I tried having a thoroughly incompetent secretary, but of course that didn't answer very well either."
It must be so wonderful to be able to think of things, said Rhoda.
Oh, I can always think of things, said Mrs. Oliver happily. What is so tiring is writing them down. I always think I've finished, and when I count up, I find I've only written 30,000 words instead of 60,000, and so then I have to throw in another murder and get the heroine kidnapped again. It's all very boring.
Rhoda did not answer. She was staring at Mrs. Oliver with the reverence felt by youth for celebrity, slightly tinged by disappointment.
Do you like the wallpaper?
Asked Mrs. Oliver, waving an airy hand.
I'm frightfully fond of birds. The foliage is supposed to be tropical. It makes me feel it's a hot day, even when it's freezing. I can't do anything unless I feel very, very warm. But Sven Kjersen breaks the ice in his bath every morning.
I think it's all marvellous, said Rhoda, and it's awfully nice of you to say I'm not interrupting you.
We'll have some coffee and toast, said Mrs. Oliver. Very black coffee and very hot toast. I can always eat that any time.
She went to the door, opened it, and shouted.
Then she returned and said, What brings you to town? Shopping?
Yes, I've been doing some shopping.
Is Miss Meredith up too?
Yes, she's gone with Major Despard to a solicitor.
Solicitor, eh?
Mrs. Oliver's eyebrows rose inquiringly.
Yes, you see, Major Despard told her she ought to have one. He's been awfully kind, he really has.
I was kind too, said Mrs. Oliver, but it didn't seem to go down very well, did it? In fact, I think your friend rather resented my coming.
Oh, she didn't. She really didn't.
Rhoda wriggled on her chair in a paroxysm of embarrassment.
That's really one reason why I wanted to come today to explain. You see, I saw you had got it all wrong.
She did seem very ungracious, but it wasn't that, really. I mean, it wasn't your coming. It was something you said.
Something I said?
Yes. You couldn't tell, of course. It was just unfortunate.
What did I say?
I don't expect you remember, even. It was just the way you put it. You said something about an accident and poison.
Did I?
I knew you'd probably not remember.
Yes, you see, Anne had a ghastly experience once.
She was in a house where a woman took some poison. Hat paint, I think it was, by mistake for something else. And she died. And, of course, it was an awful shock to Anne. She can't bear thinking of it or speaking of it. And your saying that reminded her, of course. And she dried up and got all stiff and queer like she does. And I saw you'd noticed it, and I couldn't say anything in front of her, but I did want you to know that it wasn't what you thought. She wasn't ungrateful. Mrs. Oliver looked at Rhoda's flushed, eager face. She said slowly,
I see.
Anne's awfully sensitive, said Rhoda, and she's bad about, well, facing things. If anything's upset her, she'd just rather not talk about it. Although that isn't any good, really. At least I don't think so. Things are there just the same, whether you talk about them or not. It's only running away from them to pretend they don't exist. I'd rather have it all out, however painful it would be.
Ah, said Mrs. Oliver quietly. But you, my dear, are a soldier. Your Anne isn't.
Rhoda flushed.
Anne's a darling, Mrs. Oliver smiled.
She said, Oh, I didn't say she wasn't. I only said that she hadn't got your particular brand of courage.
She sighed, then said rather unexpectedly to the girl,
Do you believe in the value of truth, my dear? Or don't you?
Of course I believe in the truth, said Rhoda, staring.
Yes, you say that, but perhaps you haven't thought about it. The truth hurts sometimes, and destroys one's illusions.
I'd rather have it all the same, said Rhoda.
So would I, but I don't know that we're wise.
Rhoda said earnestly,
Don't tell Anne, will you, what I've told you? She wouldn't like it.
Oh, I certainly shouldn't dream of doing any such thing.
Was this long ago?
About 4 years ago. It's odd, isn't it, how the same things happen again and again to people. I had an aunt who was always in shipwrecks, and here's Anne mixed up in two sudden deaths. Only, of course, this one is much worse. Murder's rather awful, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The black coffee and the hot buttered toast appeared at this minute. Rhoda ate and drank with childish gusto. It was very exciting to her, thus to be sharing an intimate meal with a celebrity. When they had finished, she rose and said,
I do hope I haven't interrupted you too terribly. Would you mind, I mean, would it bother you awfully if I sent one of your books to you? Would you sign it for me?
Mrs. Oliver laughed.
Oh, I can do better than that for you.
She opened a cupboard at the far end of the room.
Which would you like? I rather fancy The Affair of the Second Goldfish myself. It's not quite such frightful tripe as the rest.
A little shocked at hearing an authoress thus describe the children of her pen, Rhoda accepted eagerly. Mrs. Oliver took the book, opened it, inscribed her name with a superlative flourish, and handed it to Rhoda.
There you are!
Thank you very much. I have enjoyed myself. Sure you didn't mind my coming? I wanted you to, said Mrs. Oliver.
She added, after a moment's pause,
You're a nice child. Goodbye. Take care of yourself, my dear.
Now, why did I say that?
She murmured to herself as the door closed behind her guest. She shook her head, ruffled her hair, and returned to the masterly dealings of Sven Hyrsen with the sage and onion stuffing.
Chapter 18 Tea Interlude. Mrs. Lorimer came out of a certain door in Harley Street. She stood for a minute at the top of the steps, and then she descended them slowly. There was a curious expression on her face, a mingling of grim determination and of strange indecision. She bent her brows a little, as though to concentrate on some all-absorbing problem. It was just then that she caught sight of Anne Meredith on the opposite pavement. Anne was standing staring up at a big block of flats just on the corner. Mrs. Lorimer hesitated a moment, then she crossed the road.
"How do you do, Miss Meredith?"
Anne started and turned.
"Oh, how do you do?"
"Still in London?" said Mrs. Lorimer.
"No, I've only come up for the day to do some legal business."
Her eyes were still straying to the big block of flats. Mrs. Lorimer said,
"Is anything the matter?"
Anne started guiltily.
"The matter? Oh, no. What should be the matter?"
"You were looking as though you had something on your mind."
I haven't. Well, at least I have, but it's nothing important. Something quite silly."
She laughed a little. She went on,
"It's only that I thought I saw my friend, the girl I live with, go in there, and I wondered if she'd gone to see Mrs. Oliver."
"Is that where Mrs. Oliver lives?"
"I didn't know." "Yes, she came to see us the other day, and she gave us her address, and asked us to come and see her. I wondered if it was Rhoda I saw or not."
"Do you want to go up and see?"
"No, I'd rather not do that."
"Come and have tea with me," said Mrs. Lorimer. "There is a shop quite near here that I know."
"It's very kind of you," said Anne, hesitating.
Side by side, they walked down the street and turned into a side street. In a small pastry cook's, they were served with tea and muffins. They did not talk much. Each of them seemed to find the other's silence restful.
Anne asked suddenly, "Has Mrs. Oliver been to see you?"
Mrs. Lorimer shook her head.
"No one has been to see me except Monsieur Poirot."
"Oh, I didn't mean—" began Anne.
"Didn't you?"
"I think you did," said Mrs. Lorimer. The girl looked up, a quick, frightened glance. Something she saw in Mrs. Lorimer's face seemed to reassure her.
"He hasn't been to see me," she said slowly.
There was a pause.
"Hasn't Superintendent Battle been to see you?" asked Anne.
"Oh, yes, of course," said Mrs. Lorimer.
Anne said hesitatingly,
"What sort of things did he ask you?"
Mrs. Lorimer sighed wearily.
"Oh, the usual things, I suppose. Routine inquiries. He was very pleasant over it all." "I suppose he interviewed everyone."
"I should think so."
There was another pause.
Anne said, "Mrs. Lorimer, do you think they will ever find out who did it?"
Her eyes were bent on her plate. She did not see the curious expression in the older woman's eyes as she watched the downcast head. Mrs. Lorimer said quietly,
"I don't know."
Anne murmured,
"It's not very nice, is it?"
There was that same curious, appraising, and yet sympathetic look on Mrs. Lorimer's face as she asked,
"How old are you, Anne Meredith?"
I,
the girl stammered.
"I'm 25.
"And I'm 63,
said Mrs. Lorimer. She went on slowly,
"Most of your life is in front of you."
Anne shivered.
I might be run over by a bus on the way home, she said.
Yes, that's true. And I might not.
She said it in an odd way. Anne looked at her in astonishment. Life is a difficult business, said Mrs. Lorimer. You'll know that when you come to my age. It needs infinite courage and a lot of endurance. And in the end, one wonders, was it worthwhile?
Oh, don't, said Anne.
Mrs. Lorimer laughed, her old competent self again.
It's rather cheap to say gloomy things about life, she said.
She called the waitress and settled the bill. As they got to the shop door, a taxi crawled past, and Mrs. Lorimer hailed it.
Can I give you a lift? She asked. I'm going south of the park.
Anne's face had lighted up.
No, thank you. I see my friend turning the corner.
Thank you so much, Mrs. Lorimer. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Good luck,
said the older woman. She drove away, and Anne hurried forward. Rhoda's face lit up when she saw her friend, then changed to a slightly guilty expression.
Rhoda, have you been to see Mrs. Oliver? Demanded Anne.
Well, as a matter of fact, I have.
And I just caught you.
I don't know what you mean by caught.
Let's go down here and take a bus.
You'd gone off on your own ploys with the boyfriend. I thought at least he'd give you tea. Anne was silent for a minute, a voice ringing in her ears.
Can't we pick your friend up somewhere and all have tea together?
And her own answer, hurried without taking time to think.
Oh, thanks awfully, but we've got to go out to tea together with some people.
A lie. And such a silly lie. The stupid way one said the first thing that came into one's head, instead of just taking a minute or two to think. Perfectly easy to have said,
Thanks, but my friend has got to go out to tea.
That is, if you didn't, as she hadn't, wanted to have Rhoda too. Rather odd, that, the way she hadn't wanted Rhoda. She had wanted, definitely, to keep Despard to herself. She had felt jealous. Jealous of Rhoda. Rhoda was so bright, so ready to talk, so full of enthusiasm and life. The other evening, Major Despard had looked as though he thought Rhoda nice. But it was her, Anne Meredith, he had come down to see. Rhoda was like that. She didn't mean it, but she reduced you to the background. No, definitely, she hadn't wanted Rhoda there. But she had managed it very stupidly, getting flurried like that. If she'd managed better, she might be sitting now, having tea with Major Despard at his club or somewhere. She felt definitely annoyed with Rhoda. Rhoda was a nuisance. And what had she been doing, going to see Mrs. Oliver? Out loud, she said,
Why did you go and see Mrs. Oliver?
Well, she asked us to.
Yes, but I didn't suppose she really meant it.
I expect she always has to say that.
She did mean it. She was awfully nice. Couldn't have been nicer. She gave me one of her books, look.
Rhoda flourished her prize. Anne said suspiciously,
What did you talk about?
Not me.
Listen to the conceit of the girl.
No, but did you? Did you talk about the murder?
We talked about her murders. She's writing one where there's poison in the sage and onions. She was frightfully human, and said writing was awfully hard work, and how she'd got into tangles with plots, and we had black coffee and hot buttered toast, finished Rhoda in a triumphant burst. Then she added,
Oh, Anne, you want your tea?
No, I don't. I've had it. With Mrs. Lorimer.
Mrs. Lorimer?
Isn't that the one who was there?
Anne nodded.
Well, where did you come across her? Did you go and see her?
No. I ran across her in Harley Street.
Well, what was she like?
Anne said slowly.
I don't know. She was rather queer. Not at all like the other night.
Do you still think she did it? Asked Rhoda. Anne was silent for a minute or two. Then she said,
I don't know.
Don't let's talk of it, Rhoda. You know how I hate talking of things.
All right, darling.
What was the solicitor like? Very dry and legal.
Rather alert, actually.
Sounds all right. She waited a little and then said,
How was Major Despard?
Very kind.
He's fallen for you, Anne. I'm sure he has.
Rhoda, don't talk nonsense.
Well, you'll see.
Rhoda began humming to herself, She thought, of course he's fallen for her. Anne's awfully pretty, but a bit wishy-washy. She'll never go on treks with him. Why, she'd scream if she saw a snake. Men always do take fancies to unsuitable women. Then she said aloud, "Oh, that bus will take us to Paddington. We'll just catch the 4:48.
End of Disc 3.